Good evening, everyone. This is the Finance and Governance Committee meeting. My name is Cynthia Delfinos Johnson. I'm going to be standing in as chair for this committee meeting. Councilmember Quinn couldn't be here with us today. We are joined by Councilmembers Kroller and Councilmember McLeod. And we have just a couple things on the agenda tonight. The first item is an update on public records requests, and we have Andy who's here to give that presentation.
Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. Let me just go ahead and share my screen here. I have to get that up and running. Great. So that is up on the screen, and I will go ahead and start. So my name is Andy Yoon. I'm the Deputy City Clerk with the City Clerk's Office. Christy was supposed to join us today, but unfortunately she's not able to be here, so we apologize she was not able to attend. So I'm going to begin with an overview of the Public Records Act and how requests are handled in our city, and then we'll go over some key legislative mandates, and then we'll dive right into some City Clerk-specific metrics, and then we'll discuss impacts on the city, what sanctions could mean for the city, and then we'll just close out with a quick summary. So to start with some background, in 2006, the Washington public disclosure laws were recodified as RCW 4256, and they became known as the Public Records Act, which mandates the broad disclosure of public records and applies to all public agencies, whether they're state or local. It doesn't apply to court records because they're governed by rules set by other entities, and the PRA does require agencies to protect the public interest by liberally constraining requests for records and then narrowly exempting any sensitive information. And as the department responsible for management of city functions related to governmental transparency, oh my gosh, I think did my screen just disappear? Sorry about that. Give me a second here.
You can see it.
For some reason, it's disappeared on my screen.
Put it in project mode or
on the screen. 1 second. Do you mind if I stop sharing and then restart?
Sure.
Sorry. Oh my goodness.
Thanks for checking.
There we go. Okay. So I think I was on program overview. Just this slide, correct? Okay, great. Thank you. So since we're the department that oversees the city functions related to governmental transparency and the records management program, we coordinate the citywide requests. So that involves distributing to citywide staff, coordinating with them, corresponding with our requesters, managing and providing records, database tracking, and then also reporting to the state, records retention and destruction. And we also coordinate with our city's attorney's office on exemptions and redactions, and then third-party notices and nuisance affidavits. So moving right into the legislative mandate, the very first, the most important one is going to be this one, which is that we need to respond to a public records request within 5 business days of receiving the request. And you can see on this slide that listed are the response types that we can make, from providing the records within 5 business days to giving an estimate of when we think the records will become available to deny the request if there is a statutory exemption. And it sounds simple enough, but we need to be really careful to be thorough and timely, or we risk being sued for a violation. And courts rarely rule in favor of us when it comes to PRA violations. For example, the court has stated that even if we don't know what the requester is after, we still need to provide a reasonable estimate of time, even though the request might be ambiguous. So we still need to provide, oh, we think we're going to be able to fulfill this in 30 days. Here's how we interpret your request. So that's just an example of the type of nuances we have to watch for. This is another legislative mandate, and it's a newer one related to reporting. The state implemented the JLARC reporting requirement back in 2017 as a means of reporting to the legislature on the impact of public records requests, and then also to provide recommendations to the state related to continuing the state's grant program for records. So that involves consultation to cities and then training services. And it requires reporting for any agencies that have at least $100,000 in staff and legal costs associated with fulfilling public records requests in the prior year, so from January to December. And we do report as one single agency on performance metrics related to public records, management, and then disclosure. And then this one you might be familiar with as well. Following the state legislature's adoption of the Open Government Training Act back in 2014, the clerk's office has presented a training to the council every 4 years. Our last one was, I think, in February or January of this year. and it does require that all elected officials complete training no later than 90 days after taking office and at intervals of no more than 4 years. We also use the recordings of our training tools for members of the city's various boards and commissioners, and it covers records management, public records, and then the Open Public Meetings Act. So like I mentioned, we'll be focusing on the metrics associated with our office because our office overlaps multiple departments and areas. And you can see from this graph that over the past 10 years, the total number of requests that we received has really kind of steadily increased. So back in 2019, we received a record number of requests, 155 there, just before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And as of last Friday, we've handled 115 requests to date this year, and we still have the rest of the quarter to go. So, and we could surpass last year's numbers. I'll be talking about this more in a later slide, but with the increase in requests, we've also seen an increase in the scope and the complexity of requests. We're not just fulfilling one-off requests for like permits, land use records anymore, or copies of ordinances. We're fulfilling requests that require a lot of detective work and combing through thousands of records.
Good question.
Yeah.
It says it ends at 130 if it's on the trajectory.
Yep.
And you're at 118 and there's this, I guess, line that goes to it. Does that mean you're projecting it's going to be 130?
130 is the request that we had in 2021.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. So 118 is how many we've had so far this year alone.
Gotcha.
Sorry. Maybe it was actually 115. 115 so far this year.
Okay.
So this is a graph that shows that the types of requesters that we're receiving these requests from. These are the most popular requests by category, and individuals in the yellow, the law firms in the light blue, and then we've got organizations in gray, and then we've got other, which includes current and former employees, government agencies, members of the media, insurance agencies, and then our incarcerated individuals, and then people can also choose to remain anonymous. So in the gray, that comprises the bulk of our requests, and we're seeing a huge growth in development activity requests. So that's like companies that do environmental service agencies, engineering consultants, and then companies that offer commercial real estate services. And they're seeking to supplement the work for their clients by seeking available city records. And then individuals in the yellow down below, those are our second largest category, and they often have the broadest requests because they result in thousands of potentially responsive records because their requests can be pretty broad. And then we have the requests by law firms, which are in the light blue in the middle there. They're not as abundant as the other categories, but they're still really time-consuming, and they can take months to complete because they're usually in conjunction with pending litigation, or we're also dealing with high-powered law firms who do sue agencies for PRA violations. So the request by individuals and law firms take the most time because we're not only looking at a huge volume of records, we're also ensuring that sensitive information isn't accidentally released to the public. So requests by law firms, like I mentioned, they might be in conjunction with pending potential litigation or events happening immediately in the city or just regionally, et cetera. So we need to be discerning and protecting the interests of the city while adhering to the Public Records Act. For example, we recently had a requester submit a request for a city RFP that was submitted by their competitor while the bidding process had not yet closed, and we were able to navigate that by providing an estimate of when the records would become available, and then we were able to close out the RFP process first. So this slide shows the time it takes us to close a request annually. The work involved with public records requests, from complex coordination of searches, guiding staff, and then facilitating installments, they can all add up to quite a bit of time. So we start the chart on the left at 2017, which is in conjunction with the start of JLARC reporting to the state. So in the left side, you can see that we were doing a little bit better. 77% of our requests were being closed in 5 business days, and it was only taking an average 11 days to close out a request. So that's not too bad. But then we fast forward to the right side of the graph where you can see in 2021, we're only able to close about 56% of those requests in 5 days. And the percentage of requests has gone up from 6% of requests that were taking a month to fulfill all the way up to 26%. And we're averaging about 19 days to close out a request. As I mentioned in a previous slide, part of the reason that we're taking longer to close out public records requests is because the complexity of the requests we're getting are growing in scope and in size. Requesters are becoming a lot savvier in how they frame requests, and they're also requesting more types of records than ever before. And there's also just more records available to request, you know, especially with the increasing reliance on electronic systems. That all increases the number of records that the city has to manage.
Andy, I think one thing is important to point out here is you have not had your temporary laborers by any. Prior to that, they had a temporary laborer, so they had a half-time staff member helping them. And so that's part of what you're seeing here is the impact of not having that temporary labor. Yes. That temporary labor is restored in the mayor's proposed budget that's before you all right now.
Thank you. Yes, it is. And then just to close out my thought, Microsoft Teams, which we're using right now, is a really great example of this. It resulted in recorded meetings that needed to be managed. We needed to develop a policy to ensure that we were only using the features that we really needed to, and we were only recording meetings where needed. An increase in public records requests also does also translate to an increase in staff time. Like Rachel mentioned, we lost our part-time staff back in, I believe, the beginning of the pandemic in 2019-2020. But you can also see from the trend line that the work involved with public records requests has gone up pretty dramatically in the past 10 years. We took a dip in the amount of time needed to work on public records requests because luckily we saw a slight cessation in the number of public records when the pandemic first hit. So about a decade ago, it was only taking about 50 hours of staff time for approximately 90 requests. That was back in, 2011. Back then, like I said, they were requesting pretty simple things, so like copies of audio recordings, low bidder proposals, things like that. And in 2021, which is last year, we spent 1,139 hours just working on public records requests. And we're looking at things like requests for records for the Justice Center. That resulted in 5,900 records that needed to be reviewed. Requests for the mayor's non-private emails that resulted in a two-month period of time, 7,400 records. And Laurel might remember this one, but we had one request for a council retreat that resulted in 20,000 records. She supported that effort, and I know it took her a while. So the average number of time that we're spending on requests has gone up from 4 hours to 9 hours per request.
Another question. Mm-hmm. You've gone through a process where you're putting a lot of it up where people can find it, yes. And you could just give them a link to whatever the documents are. Has that reduced the amount of time that you have to do the work prepping it? Did the expense of the system pay off?
Mm-hmm. It has definitely supported our efforts. We're able to continue doing the work that we do because we have the Digital Record Center. Without it, we would be having to spend even more staff time to request because with the Digital Record Center, we have one single repository in which to search from. We can do keyword searching. We can provide thousands of records just in one link. Without that, that would all translate to staff time needed to hunt down the records in a physical file room, retrieve them, scan them, upload them. So yes, it has definitely paid off.
And then there was an effort underway from current time to older dates to scan them and get them in to that system. How far back are you now, year-wise?
So that was about 30 years ago. I believe the most recent series for permits is 2017, and we're continuing to add on new record series. So we're currently digitizing fire marshal permits. We're also adding in as-built from Public Works. So as time allows, we are definitely continuing to add in record series.
And then do you have a goal of one year a year, in addition to what's new or what you're doing?
Because the time involved with prepping the records takes time, it really is dependent on staff workload because we also need to coordinate with staff from the other departments to ensure that the records are reviewed. We need to make sure everything that may be sensitive is redacted, and then we prep those for upload into the Digital Record Center, and then we actually upload it. So it's a multi-step process, but we do the work as time allows.
Okay.
So like I mentioned earlier, JLARC is requiring agencies to report if they have at least $100,000 in staff and legal costs associated with fulfilling public records requests. So this is data taken from our payroll system. And in 2021, we spent 4,000 hours on public records requests, and we had $233,500 in total costs. And then to clarify, for staff and legal costs, other than the police records unit, which has its own team of staff dedicated records, hours and costs shown is representing time spent on public records requests by existing staff who are working on these things in addition to their regular work duties. Now, in an earlier slide, I talked about an increase in digital records that have to be managed. So in this slide, you can see an estimate of the total number of files that we've reviewed annually in response to public records requests. And I would actually say this is an undercount because it doesn't include attachments, which would double or even triple the page load. Like I said, public records requests can look like one link to the Digital Records Center, or it can look like thousands of emails and computer records, thorough attachments that we then need to review for responsiveness. We also need to check things like the tabs in Excel files. We need to check hyperlinks, and those all need to be checked for potentially exempt information. So like attorney-client privilege information, financially sensitive information, personal information, juvenile records. Those are examples of the types of exemptions that we have to look for. So this slide shows a little bit more about the steps involved in a request. We begin with interpreting requests and then establishing the criteria that provides us with the most relevant results. And setting our parameters too broadly can actually result in way too many results being returned, but it's also the safer route because if we inadvertently miss a responsive record because we were construing it too narrowly, that's one of the most common PRA violations by other agencies. We then need to review it for responsiveness, and then the last major step is to ensure that any sensitive information is redacted, and then we prepare an accompanying exemption log. And PRA laws are also constantly changing, so there's always new court cases setting new precedents and then new mandates that have to be followed. And as a result of the Neeson versus Pierce County case back in 2015, we now need to require a search of text messages stored on a public employee's cell phone. And that includes elected officials, boards and commissioners, and other city representatives. So you might have encountered that, but it's basically a signed affidavit saying that you've searched your personal cell phone. And responding to public records requests can be laborious, but the cost of non-compliance can result in some pretty hefty penalties, sanctions, and the legal fees that are imposed against the city, as well as the loss of public trust and reputation. You can see here on the screen some common aggravating factors as reasons for imposing additional penalties. And that's, you know, the current statutory penalty is $100 per day for each page of a record that was improperly denied, as well as legal costs and attorney's fees. So the goal is to do the work associated with this public records request well, because that ultimately saves the taxpayer money. And then here we have some examples of agencies that were sanctioned for violating the Public Records Act. In the first one, this happened back in 2021, in response to a request for COVID-19 testing procedure, testing records, sorry. The UW said it didn't have any responsive records, but the Seattle Times was able to show that inadequate search was performed because they had requested records from another university where the UW was involved. So they were able to show that their records had been improperly denied, and the UW agreed to pay the Times $97,000. In 2016, which is the second one, the Times requested L&I investigation records of employees who had complained about being overexposed to toxic lead, and L&I denied the records, and they claimed an exemption, but they didn't provide any information about what that exemption was, and the court found that that made no sense, and they found that more than 5,400 pages were improperly denied, and that resulted in $503,000 in fines.
What year was that?
I believe that was in 2016.
Thank you.
And then in 2022, this is a little bit more recent, but Mr. Doe sent the Port of Quincy 4 requests over the course of a few months, and one of those emails actually fell into the spam folder. So port employees missed that email, and that resulted in the penalty fee and a settlement for denial of what amounted to hundreds of records. And that was the Port of Quincy's first offense ever. And this is back in 2009. You've heard me talk about this one a little bit more. 2019, sorry. But Pierce County agreed to pay $950,000 after an 8-year battle over the former Pierce County prosecutor Mark Lindquist's text messages, which Neeson, which was another former employee, was seeking access to. And that was a landmark case because it found that text messages that are stored on an employee's private phone could be required to be disclosed, and that resulted in the implementation of Neeson affidavits, which you've encountered. So as I close out this presentation, it's important to note that the city's clerk's office has not had a failure or a sanction, and we do attribute much of that success to establishing the records management program back in 1991, which is the foundation for identifying our responsive records. And we also have 30 years of digitizing high retrieval records into the Digital Records Center, which means that we now have over 2 million images that are self-served and available online. And we're continuing to add more, like I mentioned. It also provides risk mitigation because we are able to search just one single repository, and we're continuing to build that out as staff and workload allows. We're also constantly streamlining, and we're looking for other opportunities to improve our processes and find additional efficiencies. So an example is after we had multiple requests from requesters for vendor listings from finance, we actually worked with finance staff to load that information directly into the Digital Record Center so that the requesters could self-serve those records, and we've seen a cessation in those types of requests. We're also developing best practices and systems for auditing purposes, so case summaries, standardized tracking logs, and then we also collaborate regularly with our city departments to review our policies and see what needs to be done to mitigate PRA risk. And that is it for me, and I will move to any questions.
Councilmember Crowley, do you have any questions?
Yeah, too. Jay Lark, what do they do with the information they collect? Do you see any positive outcome from that?
So far, they have released the information in a statewide report. They have not done anything with the information quite yet.
Okay. And have you had a response where you've given them a link to look through our you know, I'm trying to understand the level of response you have to provide. If they say they want to have all the minutes from the council meetings for the last 3 years, you just give them a link to the search page on our system, and then you've met your response at that point?
Depending on what type of records a requester is requesting, it can just mean that we're able to provide one link. Other times, if it's a little bit more nuanced beyond what is already in the DRC, we can sometimes provide installments through what's called a PDO or FTP site, similar to Dropbox. And that includes emails, scans of work documents that staff has created and other things like that.
Say it's in the system and you send them the search page and then they say, well, I'm disabled or I don't know how to use this system. Are you obligated in any way after that point?
Yes, actually. So where possible, we make sure that the records are accessible. So we're actually working with one requester right now who wants all the files loaded into a USB drive that they'll then come and pick up. So because sometimes there can be certain barriers to technology. We ensure that the records are accessible.
Okay. And so is it, I'm just trying to figure out what the limitations are on our obligation. At some point, you could set them up with a computer and the USB, and they could just go through those public records on their own. And they say, gee, this is tedious. Is that the end of it, or do you have to go and do it for them?
We are not obligated, we're obligated to provide their records in the most universally accessible way. They're also able to come and inspect the records in person, so we're able to provide that measure. Beyond that, let's say they want a certain type of video program to view a video file footage. We would provide that file as the most universal file type, such as AMV. They can use Windows Media Player, they can use VMI, but we aren't obligated to promote more beyond that.
Okay, thanks. Good presentation.
Thank you. Councilmember McLeod?
Just a couple questions on your legislative mandates.
Mm-hmm.
You acknowledge the request has been received and provide a reasonable estimate. Is there a definition as to what reasonable is?
The courts tend to look at staff of the current workload and our general period of what is reasonable is 30 days. We look at what we can provide within 30 days. We provide the easiest installments first, and then that can take additional time. So we do have requests that have been open for up to a year or more.
On that same page, you have a bullet item about deny the request.
Mm-hmm.
You ever denied somebody?
We have had to deny a request for being commercial. The state does allow that if a requester is seeking a list of individuals or businesses for a commercial purpose, we can deny that request. So that has happened once, but it doesn't happen very often. We can also deny a request if it's a bot request, so if it's just generated by a computer. And we can also deny additional records from being provided if the requester is not reviewing the records. So we actually just recently closed out a request because we had been providing months and months of installments, and it turned out the requester had not been reviewing them for the past 60 days.
Yeah.
So those are some examples of when we can deny records.
On your metrics,
mm-hmm.
that has the individuals, the law firms,
mm-hmm.
are you finding like all the individuals, it's the same people?
No, unfortunately. We do have some repeat individuals, but oftentimes it's people who are just coming into the city. We do have some residents who regularly request records from us, but it's not always the same.
Okay. On your metrics of sum of labor, mm-hmm. sum of benefits. Mm-hmm. How do you get your rate that you do that? That's just out of the payroll system?
Yes, it's out of the payroll system. So it's based on our time card reporting system. Finance pulls this report from us about the hours. And unfortunately, I would say that this is actually underreported because there's a little bit of inconsistency with staff using the time card system to report how much time they're spending working on requests.
Because if you pull the police out of there, those are the hours of a full-time person.
Yes.
You're saying that's low.
Yes.
Okay. And I think our last question. Are there efforts or what are you guys looking at going forward on how you can either lower cost or lower time? And what can council do to help in that?
That is a great question. So the mayor's proposed budget does provide for staff time with the...
just a 0.5, though, right?
Correct, yes. However, we're hoping that we can have additional funding for additional part-time staff to help with the clerk's office requests. The work does continue to grow, and it is all legally mandated. All the work that the clerk's office does has its own deadlines associated and their own legal mandates, and so does the public records request. So it's a fine balance of having to mitigate both work.
That's tough because, you know, all that effort and the money put towards it, it doesn't pave a road, doesn't provide a community service. Right. Well, I guess people will see that as a community service, I guess. There's a lot of people that work.
In one way, it's one of the functions of government to be transparent to the people. But it is also true that this is work that citywide, all staff are required to do. So this is in addition to our existing duties. So all agencies, I would say, across the state are struggling to find out how to incorporate this new body of work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Quiller, you had another question.
Yeah, it's 2018 that you show a spike that's significant over everything else. What was going on there?
We had some very hefty public records requests. We had one very prolific requester who was requesting multiple records. This is actually the requester that I was talking about that Laurel ended up doing a lot of records reviews.
So that's not the guy who asked every city in the state for all their records from the beginning?
That was it?
It's the gentleman who brought everybody to their email.
Yep. So that's the one.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Do we ever pass on the cost that it takes staff time to do this?
Unfortunately not, because we don't have designated public records staff in the city other than the public records officer, who is our city clerk, and the police records unit. There is no way that we know of right now to pass on.
I just asked
because it's a good question.
The courts, the agency I work for, sometimes passes the cost along to the requester.
Yes, there are pass-through charges that we can pass on to the requester. However, oftentimes we found that the calculating of the cost can be much more onerous than the benefit that we're recouping. So if we're, for example, spending time scanning 300 pages, that would amount to maybe $3 back from the requester.
Yeah. You're collect our money later. More time.
Is there a way to make it more meaningful?
We have a state fee structure that we have to follow, and unfortunately, it doesn't provide much.
All of the charts, the metrics, they capture all public records requests that are made to any part of the city.
Just for the clerk's office.
We
focus specifically on the clerk's office because we overlap with all the other departments. The other departments also have their own staff person who is responsible for handling in their own department. But citywide, I would say last year, we had maybe 3,500 to 4,000 requests.
Okay. But this one.
Yeah,
this,
that one does.
This chart captures everyone.
That captures everyone in the city.
Okay. This is a really good question, Andy. You know a lot about this, and I just really appreciate all the metrics that you put together for us. It's really informative. So I appreciate. I don't have any other questions other than to just say good job.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I've got a couple more.
Okay.
Because it made me think. So those companies that are making money by asking you to do the research, so there's no way to get revenues back for doing the work for them.
it will be to the state person.
Yeah, I think it would be worth our while. If it's not something that we can just give them on a link and tell them to go search themselves, right? So that seems like that would be difficult. That was on a question you asked.
That's Kate's response again. Send an email, go search yourself.
On this magnifying glass and you'll
fish. I think it's important for everyone to remember too that with very few exceptions, the state legislature has exempted themselves from the public record.
Oh yeah.
So until the state legislature feels the pain I think that local governments feel.
Nobody will.
We're gonna be in this gold problem.
Number of people over the police department, their public disclosure, staff, sizes.
Last count that I heard of, I believe it was three.
Three. And you guys have?
Christy and I work on the public records request within our office.
Two, and then maybe this half person.
Yes.
And then is there anybody else doing that work?
Yes, across departments. Each department has a staff liaison who's responsible for public records requests.
And you figure that's half time or full time?
I would say it's probably about half of their time.
Okay, across.
Yes, PCD, Public Works, Fire, yes.
Thanks.
Fire has a dedicated person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thought I'd mention that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job.
See you guys later.
Thank you.
Yeah. See you later.
I know it's the grass road. It's just
fine. Oh.
I can care about it later.
Yeah. Okay, next item is the proposed 2023-2024 biennial budget. There's a couple of them that we're going to be going over, and Vicki will be leading us through them.
Yeah, Vicki Carlson, Finance Director for the record. So there's four fund budgets that we'd like to review tonight. The first one is the contingency fund, and that is on page 21 of your packet. This fund requires 10% of prior year ongoing revenue as the balance. And so there's very little activity in here, right? There's interest earnings. There's no proposed use of the contingency fund in the upcoming biennium. And so it's really just interest earnings and showing that we're in compliance with that policy. If we have 10% of construction sales tax, we will set that aside. We'll do that as a budget amendment. But because the construction sales tax is so highly volatile, we just handle that as a budget amendment rather than exactly. So any questions on the contingency fund? Okay. The okay. Next
one. Yes. We'll just stop after each one.
Of course.
So for the budget, we're projecting investment earnings of 20,000.
Correct.
Seems really low to what you know as historical.
We want to be conservative. 68,000 in 2022 is our estimate. Yes, we could actually probably increase that. Good as an estimate.
Yeah. Just an observation.
Yep.
Okay. Any other questions?
Not at all. I appreciate the conservative approach. I don't have windfalls and surprise ourselves and have that problem than the other way around.
Yep, exactly. But you do raise a good point. Interest rates are rising, and so we probably are going to have additional interest earnings in that fund. And so I would be happy to make that adjustment. That would be a nice adjustment to make.
What would you take it to?
I still want to be conservative because it's still, you know, they're still talking recession. We don't know what the future holds. I would maybe bump up to 50,000, which is still conservative, but it's an increase. I would be comfortable with that.
Okay.
Any other questions on the contingency fund?
Nope.
Do you want to take that as a recommendation from the committee to move forward, or is it something to put a pin in for later?
You know what? I'm.
I think it's a latitude thing. I don't think we're giving her directions on how to do a contingency fund.
Yeah, but it actually does make sense that it's a good news story. Yeah. So
direction from the council.
I have one other question.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side of that page, the 700,000 that went out, that was the transfer for COVID?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. So page 23 and several pages beyond that, that is our debt service fund. So we do have a number of debt services that we're paying on. We've summarized the debt services that are out there on page 23 and 2024. We have no new debt proposed for the upcoming biennium, so this is all just existing debt. And it's just a reminder to go down the list. The first one we have listed is the SCORE bonds, and SCORE Jail is still planning to pay those bonds on our behalf, but we do have to show the budget. That's one of the covenant requirements for those bonds. The MPD loan is actually paid off this year, so there's no more MPD bonds that are outstanding.
Does that mean we've always been glued to some annual year-end report that they have to do with the state?
Yep, and they still do that, but we're no longer tied to that at all. So they make their last payment this year, and it's done.
And then that, so then we're totally separate. We don't have to be part of that report anymore.
We still have the operating loan that gets paid off early next year.
Okay.
But that's not tied to bonds.
Okay.
But they've been paying both of them, and yeah, come next year, then we are completely separated from the MPD.
100%. As entities, et cetera. So by, you're saying the end of next year?
I want to say April of next year-ish. It's in the middle of next year.
Okay, so if I call it soon, I can check back. Okay,
yes, thanks. Absolutely. We do have the two unlimited UTGO bonds that are paid by property tax levies. We have no more bonds to issue on that one, so that's just repayment of debt. Local Improvement District number 33, those are our bonds for the Quick Attack project. We just issued payment cycle number 9, and property owners continue to pay those. So I think that we have a really good news story with that, and that we have never had a property default on any of those assessments. So that's really, really good news. So it's not a hit to the general fund. We pay that directly from the assessments.
How far is that going to go?
15 years total.
Okay.
So,
from 2013?
Yes, that was the first year's debt assessment.
Thanks.
So those bonds will be paid up. So any questions on our debt service budget? We do have lots of charts and graphs showing the different debt service in a variety of ways.
You loaded in a lot of really good information, and I really love that one. Horizontal.
The Dennis Robertson chart.
Is that what it's called?
I think that's
whatever you call it.
It's the one on page, let me get down to it. On page 31. Is that the one you're referring to?
That's a lot closer. Mm-hmm.
I've always referred to that as the Dennis Robertson chart.
Okay. You actually had some kind of horizontal graph chart, but this is fine.
Okay. Well, there's other graphs. We do have a graph in there back up to page 29. That's a graphical representation showing all of our different debt services.
I'll go dig into another old book, come back, and show you the one that I'm thinking about. Revive that. It's just this really incredible horizon shot. And this is close enough of the data to get through here.
Sure. Any questions on the debt service budget?
That's helpful. So when I just quickly add, we're talking about $100 million or so of debt service. What percent are we out of our bond capacity?
Ooh, you know, that's a really good question. I have to look. Because I know our debt service, our capacity goes up as our assessed value goes up. And our assessed value is over $8 billion now. So I've got that calculation back in my desk. I can get that to you really easily.
But it's conservative. It's not threatening our rating or anything.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Can one of you restate that question for the minute?
Quick math said about $100 million of debt service. And what percent is that of our bond capacity?
Thank you.
Yep. I got that chart, and it was one of them that I updated for this. So that's a very easy number to grab.
Okay. Then can you, two more questions. One, the interest rates that we're seeing here, are these rates pretty normal for cities, or this is because you guys did some refinancing when rates were low?
They are rates that were locked in at the time of the debt issuance. So they will not change unless we were to default, and then we'd have more problems than just a higher interest rate.
Yeah. They're all very, very low.
They were locked in at the time of issuance, and they're based on our very, very high bond rating. We've got a AA+, which is the second highest bond rating.
That was a great time to be bonding.
Yes, it really was.
Yes, and we took bonds that we were in, and we actually redid them.
So we always look for the opportunity to refinance. In fact, you might remember last year we refinanced two debt issuances. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a ton of savings, but anytime we can get savings as we're issuing other debt, we take advantage of that. So that's one of our annual processes to see if there's any. We have to wait till they're callable. But as soon as something becomes callable, we do that research to see if there's any possibility of refinancing.
And can you explain that term so I understand it better, callable?
Yeah, so basically when we issue debt, we issue it for 20 years, and those debts must stay on the bond market for X number of years before we can, well, they call it callable, which means we can actually pull them back in. So basically pay them off and reissue new debt because the bondholders are buying that investment and they have to have a guarantee that they're going to be able to invest in that for X number of years. So when it becomes callable, that means that's when we can actually call them back, pay them off, and reissue new bonds at a ideally lower interest rate.
Okay. If you did that, would you be, you would call it back, you would pay off.
Mm-hmm.
Are you paying off with money that you would be doing new bonds with?
Yes. Okay. So basically it's a refinance. So you pay off the old bonds, you take the new debt, and then you have a new repayment schedule, which is lower than the original repayment schedule.
Okay, thank you.
And nothing dramatic is expected in the next few years. Everything's going to go up, so you won't see a lot of that activity. How, so when you come back with your percentage of our and capacity of our bond capabilities, historically for this city, we are more in debt than we've ever allowed ourselves to be in, as far as I know, historically. Am I correct?
We have paid off debt, so I think we're at a lower point now. I think a few years ago is when we were kind of at that peak. We
first started with the safety.
With the public safety plan, yeah.
So that was our biggest risk that we mm-hmm. have.
Yeah, we're starting to come down a little bit now until we start talking about the public workshops phase two. And that will be a conversation on issuing new debt for that.
Yeah. So do you think that means across the timeline of our city and its existence, we've stepped out to go do this work.
Yes.
And we've luckily done very well with it, which is nice. The times have been good to us. But that behavior, as the percentages start firing up here, is probably not going to be as easy to do, right?
It depends. So the thing is we have bond issues that are being paid off. So a couple of them drop off in the next 2 years. So the goal is that as we reissue debt for the public workshop phase two, some of that bonding capacity will go, that we paid off the old debt will go to the new debt. So you actually won't see a huge increase in total debt. It'll be a less of an increase.
But as a city, it's not our norm to be at this level. We've actually gone much higher than we've ever done. I remember sitting around on a
council. From the historical that I've been able to find, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what is the mean for us?
What is the what?
What is the average level as opposed to the extreme level that we've been at in the last couple of years? And we could continue or we could...
Got it. I can go back and look at that.
What looks normal to us?
Yeah, I can go back and take a look. I don't have that in front of me, but I can do some of that research.
I appreciate that we're down before we jump into it. Or it'd be nice to know what...
Yep. I think it's just taking that graph and just expanding it historically and adding that historical information in there.
Well, capacity also goes up as our AV.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So capacity definitely goes up.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So while Kate's statement is true, it made good business sense to borrow at that time because we were getting great rates.
Yeah.
Yes. And the project.
Taking home equity loans to buy your house.
So lowest percents we've seen in decades.
Yeah.
And the project costs were high enough that if you would have saved in order to pay cash for those projects, we still would not have built those structures. Right. So
like a family may not have taken a home equity loan in the 90s, but now their value in the home is so much higher now, it's almost normal to see people with home equity loans.
Not my house. Because the increases that are coming, and also those of us who lived in the 70s and saw at the time when we had 13%
I remember that.
On loans. We all live in some with great caution as these things go up and it's not in our control.
Right.
So either global activity or prices start to get under control or inflation gets under control.
But when you're able to then change the rate to 1 or 2 under 3%, you have some insulation against that.
Yeah. And we always look to see what the best financing tool is. But that's one reason why when we did the fire engine this time, we proposed an interfund loan as opposed to going out to the market because we could do it
better.
We could do it better than if we went through the local program with the state.
That's for sure.
Yep.
What we need to pay attention to that.
A question just about SCORE. I'm just trying to understand how this works. So there they're now paying the debt down. Do we pay anything for SCORE still?
We do. We have an annual assessment for operating costs because we're an owner city. And so we always pay that. But we have a lot of contract cities that contract with the jail. And so they're using that contract revenue to basically benefit the owner cities. So they're paying the SCORE debt on our behalf. If the contract cities decrease, it could come back at some point in the future where we would have to start repaying that debt. When they first issued that debt, we did have to pay for it. The financial picture with SCORE has changed enough that they're able to do that on our behalf. So, but their covenants do require us to budget for it, so we do have to show that the budget is there.
Federal Way did drop out. But the others are hanging in there, and the contract cities are happy?
Yeah, so far it's been very positive, and I sit on the finance committee for SCORE. We meet monthly. They're always talking about other agencies that are contacting SCORE because they want a contract. So it's managing the number of beds that are available with the staffing. They've got another pod that they could open up, but they're still impacted staffing-wise because of COVID. So it's that balancing act between bringing in contract revenues because you still have to have enough beds for the owner cities. So that's the balancing act that they continue to do. But it's been a very successful story as jails go.
Yeah, I actually read a blog from somebody in Des Moines that maybe they were putting forward a blog and they said they were down to 300 beds when they'd been like closer to 500 or 600 beds. And that's because of the COVID distancing. But is that all changing with the vaccinations and things? Are they able to open those?
They're struggling with staffing just like everybody else is.
So it's a staffing thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And just historically, so you know, King County used to be where we'd send everybody. All of us in this little coalition. And then one day they woke up and said, we don't have room for you. You're too much trouble. You guys go figure out where you're going to put people. And so part of the long process for us was to come up with a SCORE answer for South Cities. And then all of a sudden, King County couldn't get enough people in the beds. There's laws had changed, a lot of things had changed, and there was much more interest in us for utilizing sending people up to King County again. So we've been hanging on pretty tight to the situation, but it's worked out well for us. But it's very, very unusual for cities to have their own jail. Yes, they're really big.
What happened Federal Way? Why did they pull out?
To be perfectly honest, they thought they could do it less expensively elsewhere and bought a bottom line. But I also know they're back using our beds again.
Right. Yeah.
I'm kind of trying to process. You're going
to Yeah. Seattle uses King County's jail, obviously. And they're actually connected by a tunnel to the bridge. Yeah. Okay.
All right. I don't have any more questions for you guys.
No.
So the next fund is our Fire Improvement Fund. This is the fund that is connected to our public safety plan. We collect fire impact fees here. The budget that's in there for 2023 and 2024 aligns with our D20 model. If you remember, the D20 model is how we funded the public safety plan in general. So growth pays for growth. These are anticipated growth costs coming in for fire impact fees. We receive the revenues in Fund 304. The fire impact fees actually take quite the wild ride to end up where they finally end up because they're transferred from this fund where they're collected into the public safety plan fund. And then from there, they're used to pay off the debt service that is specific to the public safety plan. So it is an allowable cost fees of fire impact fees for debt service. And that is the only activity in this fund.
What is accounting for this big increase in 2022-23 in the revenues? Like it goes from 150 projected to then 300.
So we always budget 300,000. That's what's in the D20 model. At some point, Tukwila South is going to start developing. And so there are pockets where we could receive development fees from fire impact fees. The budget is, like I said, it follows the D20 model, which accounts for $300,000 every single year. That's what we base the budget on. And then we true it up as we see the year materialize. So this year we're expecting $150,000. We might actually get up to $200,000 this year.
Yes. I remember in previous years that there was, and I don't know if this is in the budget, this big budget book. But there, I remember Derek putting together a chart for us on all of the city properties that are like that we're trying to sell is part of the D20 model and some not.
Correct.
Is that part of this, the budget?
Yes, just not this fund. So you'll see in Fund 305, which I believe has already been reviewed by committee, you'll see the sale of the George Long shops. That revenue is being split part into the public safety plan fund and then part into Fund 306, which is to pay directly for the public works shops, phase one, some of those costs. So that's the one piece of property that we know is being sold now, so that's in the plan. There's some other properties that we're looking at selling, but we're not to the point where they're going to be part of the budget yet. But that's the old Station 51, old Fire Station 52, the new Porter site, Long Acres. So there are several pieces of property that are part of this plan that hopefully eventually will sell.
With the exception of 52, though, we did find out that that's deed restricted.
It's what?
It's deed restricted.
Ah, okay.
The old thing up on the hill.
Oh, okay.
Going up by the
did not know that.
Historical museum.
Okay.
My bad.
Oh, no, no worries. But there's a lot going on, so that'll be something to. And then, of course, with the land sales, it's always a good conversation about, you know, do you sell them? Do you keep them for a long-term lease? So, but right now, the George Long Shops is the only one that's actually actively in the budget that you'll see.
So on the construction of the Inter Urban Hotel, we made a few tax waves. I can't remember whether we waived. I can't believe we would have waived our firing tax fee, but I cannot remember.
Boy, I remember that deal. There were certain fees that were waived. There were other fees that could be paid at a later date.
Yep.
And I believe the impact fees were part of that paid off over time. And they've paid that whole agreement off.
Is that hard for you to just get a summary page?
I have to go back and dig for that. And we can find it. We just have to dig for it because it's been several years.
I don't want to be like a sign or anything, but it's easy just to kind of say, here's how far we are into it now. But
they definitely paid it off. They paid it off, gosh, 3 or 4 years ago.
It's all paid off, but we can get economic development. It's all in there.
Yeah, they would probably have it.
They're
just trying to jog my memory on how far out they got with some of this stuff.
They're all trued up. They've paid everything according to the agreement.
Okay.
I think the only thing that's still out is probably the MST.
Yes, that exemption is still in place, so that's the property tax exemption.
Yeah, that's for like 10 years, right?
I believe so.
Are we like 3 years into it?
Yep.
Okay.
So there's still several more years of that one.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Have to look around.
Perfect. Any other questions on the fire impact fee fund? Okay. The last fund then to talk about is Fund 502, which are self-insured healthcare plans. That starts on page 35. 36 is the actual financial statements for that one. So we do work with an actuary every biennium to determine what those costs should be. There's a few little differences with this particular that I want to point out. So first of all, we do have a pretty significant fund balance this year, and so we are right-sizing the fund, so you'll actually see less revenue going in than expenses because we're right-sizing that fund. We're utilizing existing fund balance to bring that down to a more reasonable amount, but you're still going to see a few $100,000 in there because, number one, we do have one big contract that's open. That's the Teamsters, and so we plugged in an estimate for what we hope will happen with the negotiations, but that remains to be seen, so that's a big question. The other big question that we have is this is based on firefighters no longer being part of the pool, so we have 67 less employees, and we have an estimate of what we think those impacts are going to be, but we don't truly know the impacts, and so we do want to be conservative with that, so that's why we are still leaving some fund balance in there just because we don't know what the impacts of losing 67 firefighters are going to be. Less people, but they're also higher users, so.
And we've kept the IBNR as high as it was with the existing census. So there will likely be more right-sizing of this fund as we continue this transition.
Yeah, but there's just a lot of unknowns right now. So we think this is a conservative budget. We'll obviously be watching this very closely. And if we see something that looks alarming, we will obviously report back to council as soon as we see anything noteworthy.
So you made an interesting comment about the firefighters that they use it heavily. So are they?
And actually, that was probably an incorrect statement because a lot of it's on the job. So it's L&I.
Yeah.
So it's not.
So the job goes to L&I, and they would be considered a healthy set of people given their age.
Yeah. So that was incorrect for me to say. I should have just said 67 less employees. Period.
So
we don't know the effects.
An actuary would be pleased with them, and in a pool of people, given the kind of health capabilities that they promote versus people sitting at desks all the time.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So they said that is like, yeah, okay. Can't take that one back.
That was, it all is more expensive. What's the actuary, you know, do you sit back and just say, generally speaking, other than trying to get more employees involved in premiums, I guess is what you call it.
We do have a lot of conversations with them. We do have a new broker this year. Okay. So we've had a lot of conversations on looking at different options that are out there for us to reduce costs. With them being so new, there's been a lot of ideas. We just haven't had a chance to really dig into those ideas and see which ones can really make a big difference. Right now, the biggest one is the premium sharing.
Yeah, and that's helping us keep even with the market. It's not really a massive savings for us, right? Does that make sense the way I said it?
It's been a while since I've looked at that actuarial.
The costs have been really high, right? So all we're trying to do is stay within a reasonable expense range for ourselves.
Yeah, so I would say that actually our population is changing pretty significantly, and it's actually, this is the first time since I've been here, we're not having a rate increase from 22 to 23.
Okay.
There's no rate increase because we are, you know, we've seen longer tenured employers or employees, right, coming off the plan. And that is one thing I will say about FIRE is that, you know, a third of them are of retirement age.
Yeah.
So that's just a reality of all of us, right? So our plan is changing as our median age starts to go down, and it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. But so we did not experience significant rate increases this year like we've seen previously. But that's because our population is changing, not because the cost. The other thing is that we do expect next year to see much higher increases because the healthcare contracts go for 3 years. So we're kind of in this sweet spot right now where they couldn't add in the inflation that we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we expect that to be a different story next year, the year after.
So our philosophy of being self-insured is not the prevalent approach for a lot of cities, correct? At one point, there was only a couple of cities that were even doing it in the state.
There's a few of us. Yeah, I mean, there's more than just a couple.
Okay, but out of, what is it, 481 cities, towns, and whatever,
I can't tell you how
we're probably more in the 5 percentile than we are in the 95 percentile.
I do.
Okay. Just wondering about that philosophy, where we're at, and whether or not it's... I think it pays well. It pays off well. I think the plan is extremely good, which is attractive for recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm wondering is, how do we make that decision on whether we continue with the self-insurance approach versus other insurance approaches? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
And that's what our brokers are there to help us with, right? So one of the questions that we have, you know, we have a small pool of retirees that we're responsible for, the last retirees, mm-hmm. right? The broker came to us and said, you may actually want to do some research to fully insure them, right? So take that smaller population. It may be cheaper for us to fully insure them. So that's what the brokers help us with.
Yeah.
And we're very pleased with this.
They would be interested in our philosophy, having listened to the broker as to why we stay with self-insured over others. What is the thinking behind that financially? Right?
Yep. And
we can model talk all day, but I just want to know why they think it's beneficial to stay with where we are. Is it the size of our city? Is it the health of our employees? What's triggering us staying in self-employed? And then I'd like to know how many cities are self-insured, I didn't mean employed, self-insured compared to the statewide figures, if that's all right.
Yeah, we can see what kind of information the brokers have.
Okay, thanks. I mean, AWC may be able to help you with that. It may not be a big dive or humorous.
Yeah, we'll take a look. We'll see what we can help with.
Thanks.
Questions? I have a question that leads to a comment. So, again, I would have asked about the investment earning. Seems low, but I guess I would take it to, you know, the previous fund. We went from 20 to 50. This would go from 6 to something. And I wonder if at some point we get enough to hire another 0.5 records person if all the funds are a little less conservative, which I'm in favor of being conservative. Being a little more accurate.
Yeah, well, this one's tough to raise. You see, back in 2021, we only had $1,500 in the interest earnings. Mm-hmm. We're only projecting $6,000 for this year.
Yeah.
That's because we don't maintain the fund balance like we do in the contingency fund. The contingency just sits there. This fund, as soon as we bring it in, we're paying it out. So there's not enough sitting there really to really
meet
that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's it.
Yep.
Wait, don't we have a...
Is it a dump?
Is that a...
It's not a problem.
Is that our engineer? Okay. He's a great dog. although it's a husky.
And he is miscellaneous.
Oh.
Wait, Laura?
No.
I think that concludes our meeting. Thank you.
Okay.